Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winicky, and I am the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, fire keepers of the Haudenosaunee, the Indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before I introduce this morning's speakers, I want to again thank everyone for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to a virtual platform. I am now honored to introduce this morning's speakers, Dr. David Larson and Dr. Hyatt Green. Dr. David Larson is an epidemiologist with expertise in global health. His work focuses on the surveillance, control, and elimination of infectious disease at the population level. In March 2020, Dr. Larson began the SARS-2 EWSP project in response to the coronavirus pandemic. The SARS-2 EWSP aims to provide clear and actionable understanding, including early warning, on coronavirus transmission dynamics to safely guide reopening. The SARS-2 EWSP is a large initiative with a team of scientists from Syracuse University, SUNY ESF, and SUNY Upstate. Dr. Hyatt Green is an environmental microbiologist at SUNY ESF, who, even before COVID, loved playing around in dirty water, most notably as a postdoctoral fellow with the National Academies of Sciences at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Dr. Green is the lead of method development for the SARS-2 EWSP project, and with the help of Dr. Frank Middleton, developed the method to detect SARS-CoV-2 currently used across New York State and elsewhere. Please join me in welcoming this morning's speakers, Dr. David Larson and Dr. Hyatt Green.
It's nice to be with you this morning, early. We're excited, Hyatt and I are excited to present something that we've been working on since March, and with the goal of having it ready this fall. And we're just about there. And so we call this the SARS-2 USP, and it's an early warning surveillance platform. We'd like to roll it out throughout New York State, and it's a big collaboration. The idea is that we collect data from wastewater. We analyze that in the lab for the presence of an amount of SARS-2 RNA. We then model the transmission and give early warning of potential increases, and then also give confidence that it's under control in other areas. And that's able to prompt early and targeted intervention and also reinforce the confidence in the public that we're doing a great job with coronavirus control. Our next slide, please, Emily. All right, so here's kind of the layout we'll go through. I'll talk about the history of wastewater surveillance for infectious disease, introduce the team, and it's a large team. Hyde and I are just two of those large teams. We'll talk about the goals of the platform, the method, our scaling, the lessons we've learned, and our next steps, and then it's also a large group of industry partners that we're working with as well. So wastewater surveillance is when we monitor sewage for the presence and of infectious disease pathogens. Everybody uses the bathroom, and so it becomes a random sample or a representative sample of people that contribute to that sewer system. And it's really an old technology, the idea of it. You know, it's developed in the early 19 or mid 1900s, and then got wide-scale application in the 1990s in the fight against polio in other countries in sub-Saharan Africa and Middle East and things. And with poliovirus, they've actually documented where they've gone in and used wastewater surveillance to prevent any cases of paralysis among children. Since the 1990s, wastewater surveillance has been adopted to look at illicit drug use, microbial resistant, and then now SARS-CoV-2. All right, next slide, please. And so the process is, first we sample sewage. We pull that from, here in the States, we pull that from wastewater treatment plants or upstream from manholes, from pump stations and different things. We then have to process that sample before the laboratory analysis. And we do this the second step in the lab with methods that Hyatt will talk about that he and Frank developed. And then when they test for the presence of pathogens, once we can document those, whether SARS-2 RNA is there, then we have to deploy interventions and figure out what to do. With polio, it's much easier because you just roll in and do mop-up vaccinations. With SARS-CoV-2, it's a little bit more nuanced because our interventions are broad stroke interventions like social distancing. That also makes this even more valuable. All right, next slide, please, Emily. And so numerous benefits for wastewater surveillance. You know, you get a representative sample of the population that's connected to the sewer. It doesn't give any identifiable information. So we're not having to deal with HIPAA or anything like that. And then we're not identifying infections that way. It's independent of diagnostic testing of cases. And so early in the pandemic, we had a real shortage of diagnostics. Now we have diagnostics that we need, but we might start to see a strain with the flu season if we get more influenza coming in through the winter. And then we might get what we call behavioral resistance to diagnostic, where people don't want to go get tested. And that's documented in certain demographics in the U.S. who have a historical legacy of racism in the health system and things like that. It's independent of symptoms. And so what's really nice is you don't have, for coronavirus to get tested, for a person to get tested, you have to first have symptoms and then go get a diagnostic. For wastewater, we can pull the wastewater and then independent of symptoms, that person will be shedding the RNA. Then it's highly cost effective. And so the sample analysis from one wastewater sample is similar to testing like 400 or 500 people in that same community. And so in a crude sense, it's 400 to 500 times more cost effective than testing populations to document transient transmission. All right, next slide, please. So here's our team, one of the Zoom photos we've taken. I'm the coordinating lead. I feel sometimes like an orchestrator, sometimes like a, but I'm also part of the modeling team. So I'm, and then our laboratory analysis team, we have lots of folks here, our modeling team, information science team, and it's a huge group effort between three universities, and we're starting to bring in folks from the CDC, folks from the State Health Department, folks from our industry partners at Quadrant and Arcadis. All right, next slide, please. So the goals of the SARS-2 USP are to first give confidence that transmission is under control and social and economic engagement is safe. The devastating effects of the pandemic won't be over until the public is confident that it's safe to go out, it's safe to mingle. And as an example, you know, we're in the city of Syracuse, transmission has been low for months. And so I signed my daughters up for soccer. And typically their soccer program has about 150 children in each age group. And this year they have 30 in an area where transmission is very low. And so we need to reinforce the idea that it's safe, but to use data to give us an early warning if it increases. The SARS-2 allows us to estimate transmission trends in real time quicker than we can do so with diagnostics from people. We want to guide public policymakers through the reopening phases. And that early warning, we'll talk about some of the evidence we've seen so far across upstate New York and the potential of a second wave coming. All right. Yeah. Next slide, please, Emily. Thank you. Hi, you want to take from here?
Yep. Yeah. And thanks, Dave. I just want to reiterate, you know, what you said. It's just a pleasure to speak with everyone this morning on this work that we've been working on for a few months. So I'll just give an overview of the method that we developed with Frank Middleton, and then talk about another tool, a bacteriophage that we're using to help interpret that data. And then before we go to the next slide, the image to the right there is basically pelleted wastewater. It's what we get about halfway through the concentration method, and so that is the pellet provided from the ultra sucrose method that Dave mentioned. All right, next slide, please. So when we first started this out, the goal was to develop a method that's very sensitive but also very scalable. If we can't take this technique and scale it up to all the areas that are going to need it, it's just not as useful of a tool. So very early on, this was a process. The workflow was split between Upstate Medical University in the laboratory of Frank Middleton and my lab at SUNY ESF. And just to take you really briefly through the process without going into too many details, we'll take a wastewater sample. We were very lucky to be able to work with Onondaga County and the great wastewater engineers at the Metro Wastewater Treatment Plant. They were very willing to collect and provide samples that we could experiment with. And so this is, we basically take just a small volume of wastewater. You can't give a good wastewater presentation without a nice shot of the actual dirty wastewater there. So that's what it looks like. This is one of the particularly dirty samples. So we load 20 milliliters of wastewater in an ultracentrifuge tube, and then underneath of it, we put a very viscous sugar solution. It's just a sucrose solution underneath that. We spin that in an ultracentrifuge. So an ultracentrifuge is basically an overpriced vertical style dishwasher that spins our sample extremely fast, 150,000 times the force of gravity for 45 minutes. And we can process about 6 samples at a time. So this step right here is certainly our bottleneck. After we take it out of the ultracentrifuge, we see that a lot of these contaminants, these low density contaminants, are resting right on top of that dense sucrose layer, while the viral RNA and really a lot of other stuff, impurities are pelleted down to the bottom of the tube. And so we can take that pellet, extract the RNA from it, and use, basically take it to qPCR, which is basically the technique that's used to test a nasal swab or a saliva swab. The latter half of the process is very similar to what's used for testing those individual swabs. So we, of course, test for SARS-CoV-2, but we also are looking at a member of the human microbiome called CRAS phage. Then we get the data analysis just on our end. We get much more fancy with this, but we can then classify that sample as below the limits of quantification, non-detect, or high enough that it's quantifiable. Then we can actually put a number to how many genomes of SARS are in the wastewater. I should say before we, so this is how the process was implemented. Right now, Quadrant Biosciences is doing every step of this process, all in one lab. So next slide, please. So when we're trying to interpret SARS data, it's really helpful to have some other virus that we co-quantify that tells us that we're doing a good job. So we have decided to target a bacteriophage or phage, which is also a virus, but it infects a member of the human microbiome that's very abundant. So we all hear about how many bacteria are in our guts. Well, the rule of thumb is that there's about 10 viral particles per bacterial cell in the human gut. And so what that means is for any bacteriophage, they're at huge abundances in the human gut. So at about 10 to the 7th per gram. And so what that means is that this is probably the most abundant microbe in the human gut. We also have a test, a qPCR assay that we can just pull off the shelf that's been previously published. And our main goal with this, well, we have a few goals. One is, can CRAS phage be used as a population denominator to account for dilution, to account for population density, or potentially decay of SARS-CoV-2 wastewater or RNA in wastewater? And at the bare minimum, can it be used as a quality control to ensure the recovery of viral RNA. I showed that wastewater sample earlier with very, as you can imagine, a lot of impurities in it. So if we're not able, if some of those impurities get change our process, and we're not able to get Cras phage RNA out, then we probably have a pretty low confidence that we're able to get SARS-CoV-2 out as well. And next slide. So essentially what we're doing here is we're co-quantifying Cras phage with SARS-CoV-2. And so we know SARS-CoV-2 infects human cells, whether it's in the human gut or in the wastewater system, that RNA is released. And then that RNA throughout the wastewater system over a period of days decays and is probably diluted with things like the water that you use to take a shower or flush the toilet. And so that results in lower detection than we would otherwise expect of SARS-CoV-2. So in order to account for all that, we quantify Cras phage, which is infects a bacterial host, which also lyses when it hits the wastewater system. And that RNA will experience that same decay and dilution. And the idea is, there's a lot of math behind this, which I won't go through, but the idea is that we can use Cras phage as a denominator, as a population normalizer, to account for both decay and dilution. So a very low SARS-2 signal would result in a low number of cases or low level of disease. A really high SARS-CoV-2 to Cras phage ratio would maybe be proportional to a relatively high level of disease in the community. Okay, next slide.
And so currently, you know, we're operating in 14 different counties, communities scattered across 14 different counties. And it's about 12 universities, and there's more that are signing on, and we'll show you why in a minute. And the goal here is to scale this thing across the entire state, is what we'd like to see. All right, next slide, please. And so in that regard, we partner with Quadrant Biosciences. Quadrant Biosciences, they're a technology business of the year in 2019. They're part of the Startup New York Economic Development Program. It's a small business here, based here in Syracuse, and been great partners. And they analyze right now, I think it's like 300 samples a week or so, and they're ready to scale up to more. And then as with the state platform, you go beyond that even. All right, next slide, please. And we've also partnered with Arcadis. Arcadis is an engineering firm, an international engineering firm. And we're working with them on the New York State Department of Health pilot, where the Arcadis does a sampling. They're experts in sampling, and there's a lot of engineering and science that goes into how to pull wastewater samples upstream from the treatment plants, which we've seen a lot of value in. And for a city as large as Syracuse or Albany or Buffalo, it's nice to be able to section out the different parts of the city to see where transmission is increasing or decreasing there. Next slide, please. And so now, this didn't quite turn out. So now the lessons learned from our platform. This figure here shows the difference in cases, COVID-19 cases, 5 to 9 days following the wastewater sample. With the wastewater sample grouped into three different categories. And so we have non-detection here on the bottom. When we don't detect any SARS-2 RNA in the wastewater sample, typically over the next week, we might see 1 to 2 cases, maybe 3 cases per 10,000 population. Sometimes we see a few more with some outliers here. When we detect it, the SARS-2 RNA, but it's still below the limit of quantification, then there's a clear difference between non-detection. Right? And then when it's quantifiable, we see a lot more cases with a large range. All right. Oh, we're going a little fast. If you can back up.
Yeah,
you're all right, Emma.
Give me one second.
It's those updates. Right. Yeah. And so we're getting great results in terms of what do the data mean as they come out of the lab. And we're working always on improving these models. All right, next slide, please. Now, in terms of an early warning, does this then give us an early warning of increases cases? And we're just going through some case study of three different universities, SUNY Albany, or SUNY Cortland, SUNY Oswego, and SUNY Oneonta, which is in Otsego County. And when we look at the levels of in the wastewater, those precede the levels of SARS-2 in the wastewater, those preceded the outbreaks on those campuses by about a week. Right. And so this, so if you take a look at Cortland here, Cortland is, and we'll show Cortland again, they had non-detection throughout the summer. And then as the students started coming back, you know, this first point in early August is coincides with a little bit of a cluster they had. And then it's in September, the students start coming back and we get an early signal that something's happening. And then a bigger signal over time that helped to give warning of an outbreak on campus. And over time, we'll be able to watch this to see if it's going up or going down to understand whether that outbreak is contained or whether it's spread into the community. And this is based on the wastewater sample from the treatment plant itself. In Oswego, these wastewater values are from the west plant where the campus is. We had a little bit of variance and then it's jumped up, spiked up on September 1st before we had indication that there was going to be a big spike in transmission from the testing data in Oswego campus. And the wastewater data were very informative to the university administration. These wastewater data were from the community, but SUNY Oswego also is doing wastewater surveillance on campus, and they're able to identify which residence halls have greater infections and which are actually clear of SARS-2 infections, and to guide their testing. And then in SUNY Oneonta, where they had, I think, 700 cases on campus over the course of a week, we saw an early signal in the wastewater that preceded their understanding in the case data. And then throughout that outbreak, they used the wastewater data to target where to sample. And the Oneonta folks were able to use, because they responded so quickly to the wastewater data, they had planned to do mass testing of the students and they accelerated that testing by about a week. And we think they actually prevented perhaps a larger outbreak than even was witnessed. And so, you know, applause to them for responding to the data so well and working well with that. Next slide, please. And if we look at it, and we're getting into a case study with SUNY Oneonta, and when we look at it, you know, we have the wastewater surveillance beginning, low level of detection, students come back to campus, again, a low level of detection, and it's like, all right, something's happening here. Before there was even a first positive COVID-19 test, and then as the cases went up, right, we had that early warning. And so if we look at this 820 detection as an early warning, because over down here between August 5th and August 20th, we had a couple of points where it was not detected. And we see an early warning, and it provides that. All right, next slide, please. And it's also, with Oneonta, we've also seen it come down, which has been really nice for them to give that. The next, so early warning is one aspect of this platform that it seems to be working really well. The other aspect of this platform that's working well is the probability that a community has it under control. And so we're going to use Cayuga and Cortland. In Cayuga, we're monitoring at the Auburn Wastewater Treatment Plant, and in Cortland at the City of Cortland Treatment Plant. And both these communities saw a lot of non-detection of SARS-2 RNA throughout the summer, right? In Cayuga, if we back up into May, they had detection in May. And then in June, it dropped off to non-detection. And so in June, it's non-detection. And so here on the y-axis is the probability that SARS-2 is absent from the community or at least controlled. And these principles are from agricultural epidemiology. It's called freedom from disease sampling, right? And so, sorry, the chat's throwing me off. And so mid-July, we started seeing non-detection of SARS-2 RNA in Auburn. and we start to get this increasing probability that transmission is controlled to a high extent, right? And repeated observations of non-detection give increasing probability that it's controlled. And so you think about this in terms of public confidence to engage with schools and businesses, it goes up, right? And then with the onset of schools, we expect an increase in transmission and it's come back down. In Cortland as well, the same kind of thing. We started in late May, and the probability that the confidence with every non-detection sample over time increases that transmission's controlled. And then in mid-July, they have, you know, this little cluster here, it drops off. They control that and confidence goes back up. And then with the SUNY Cortland opening, a little bit of increase in transmission and it goes back down. And so this is one of the cool features that that'll definitely help as we try to handle this pandemic over the next year. All right, next slide, please, Emily. All right, so one of the next steps is a statewide dashboard that shows alerts and threat levels, as well as using the Freedom from Disease principles where coronavirus is under control. And we're working on a public release. We got to coordinate with all our county partners. This is historical data, you know, this is not current, but this is the kind of thing where we use what's called the county harmonization model. We take all the wastewater samples, run some trends analysis, harmonize those within the county, and then we get an idea of what's the two-week trend. Is it increasing in these orange areas or is it decreasing in these blue areas? And this isn't current, so you just disregard it. It's from a few weeks ago. And then we can also check the confidence, right? And so a place like Oneonta, which is over here, after the outbreak, they had a clear confirmation that, yeah, things are getting better, right? And you think about how helpful that is for a community that saw such an explosive outbreak moving forward, and it's getting better with high confidence, as an example. And then other places, this is about right when SUNY Oswego was starting to have their outbreak, and you see something's happening in Oswego as it's starting to go up. And so this stuff's coming out over the next couple weeks. And I know I've promised that for a while now, so I'm not an IT person, so it's frustrating, but moving forward. All right, next slide, please. And then we're working with the New York State Department of Health on how to respond to these data, right? I want to, you know, our goal is to make the data public, to make the information public, and that we have public health messaging around this, a simple advisory that transmission or RNA, SARS-2 RNA in the wastewater, we've seen an increasing trend over a couple of weeks. Be vigilant with your mask use. Be vigilant with social distancing. We can also fashion public health messaging around levels of transmission. It's high in these communities, or it's low in these communities. And then the risk of coronavirus will always be here until we have a fully vaccinated population or a controlled or sufficiently vaccinated population. And so then it's saying, well, which counties have the higher risk and move forward with that. All right, next slide, please. All right, and then I think we're wrapping up. Here's our partners. We've worked with a lot of folks and it's been a fantastic journey so far. A huge team of scientists from all three universities here in the city of Syracuse, our industry partners with Quadrant and Arcadis, and then our civil partners with the Department of Health and the New York State Association of Counties, work with the county health organizations as well. Wastewater treatment plants from all the counties are working with us, the municipalities, and then all the universities also. All right, next slide, please. And a big thank you. We have, and I put two Zoom shots up here because we can never get everybody in a single photograph, which is those photographs of huge teams are really valuable. And then a big thank you to funding. We had initial funding from Syracuse University and ESF and the SUNY Discovery Fund, and then more recent funding from the New York State Department of Health pilot program.
Thank you so much. So we're going to open it up to questions from the audience. So I have one to get us started. Can this be expanded beyond New York State?
Yes. A number of different states have now rolled out statewide platforms. Utah, Michigan, Ohio, Missouri is going to roll one out or disclose one here shortly. And so, yeah, and the CDC is starting to coordinate this with a national surveillance platform. So we expect it to be increasing in as people are jumping on and adopting this technology. We're in discussions with the state to expand New York State with New Jersey as well. And I would love to have the more centralized approach and consistency of methods, the more valuable the data will be. And so we're hoping that that we see like a regional platform as the Northeast has really done well with the coronavirus pandemic to date.
And what is the collection frequency?
So the so collection frequency is a good one. We think there's a lot of variance in wastewater, in the signal of RNA in the wastewater. And that comes from a few different reasons. You have the variability in people shedding the virus when they use the toilet. You have toilet behavior that varies because people don't always use the same toilet. And then you have variability in the sample pulling a representative sample out of the wastewater. And so given that variability, the more frequent you can sample, the better off we'll be. For the New York State Department of Health, we're sampling 3 times weekly with the state funding. With different institutions and municipalities, it might be 2x weekly or 1x weekly. And budget is probably the limiting factor here that limits that. I think my personal thought is 3x weekly is probably the ideal. And then 2x weekly is better than 1x weekly, and then 1x weekly is good. And so I wouldn't get beyond 1x weekly. That's probably a lower limit.
We have a question. How was this used to detect the positive test at SU and track it back to a certain floor at the residence hall?
So with SU, we are monitoring points outside of the dormitories. And when we get a signal detection, we go through and we test individuals. The most recent residence hall floor that was quarantined for 24 hours was due to incident COVID-19 cases from that floor. We had a number from that floor, and that prompted a quarantine. Testing across South Campus, across the Mount as well, was reflective of wastewater surveillance. And so when we get a positive detection that we suspect is not due to post-infection shedding, then we'll go through and test everybody and see if we can find that person. There is a hypothesis among a few of the institutions that the wastewater will pick it up even before it's detectable by the human diagnostics. And so we're having to try to, you know, figure out that aspect as well. In terms of early warning, it might be even earlier than is, you know, for a reflexive testing operation that is useful. But that's still to be sorted out.
We kind of have a related question here. So if you find positive tests in the wastewater treatment facilities, how do you go back to find the source, or can you not do that necessarily?
So if we find it at a treatment plant, we have the potential to go upstream from the treatment plant to sector out areas where there might be transmission is more intense. And so working with the County Health Department in Albany as part of the New York State pilot, we were able to take a map of the city of Albany and identify the neighborhoods that are troublesome, and then they can use that to guide not only their contact tracers, but also their testing operations to try to target those neighborhoods. And so even though we might not go through and test an entire neighborhood or an entire quadrant of the city, it's still extremely useful for the city to understand, all right, here it's increasing, or here it's absent, or here it's low or high or decreasing and whatnot. To mobilize resources, you know, when we talk about pandemic response, we often talk, the narrative has often been the resources in terms of diagnostic tests, but the human personnel resources are also limited. And so if we can target our human efforts, our people, to where the transmission is increasing, then that would be extremely helpful.
We've got a question about the graph from Oneonta. Does that data represent the city or the SUNY campus, or a combination of the two of those?
So the wastewater, which graph? So the first graph, the three panels above and below was the wastewater treatment plant in the city of Oneonta, and then the cases at the county. And then Max made the other graph. Yeah. So this one here is the cases are the from the state public database, the county reported cases. And then the wastewater is from the Oneonta treatment plant itself. And we have more fine data. We're doing a deep dive into what happened to Oneonta, working with the SUNY Oneonta folks there. And then you know, the other graph a little better.
Yeah, the second plot on the next slide, I believe, that is, we're not showing any case data there. Just that's all just wastewater data. There's the ratio of SARS 2 to CRAS phage. And so,
that's the camp. Those are all campus points, right?
Yes, right. So these are all campus wastewater samples.
We've got a question about a comment that was made. Does it make sense to test citywide in the city of Syracuse, because we know that there may be some positive tests because of some cases at Syracuse University? Does it make sense to do a citywide test because we know that there's already going to be those positive tests in there?
Yeah, so my opinion, it does make a lot of sense. We know that there'll be some level of transmission going, and some level of RNA is likely to make it into the city. What we want to make sure, and the city of Syracuse, perhaps it's one of it has two large threats in terms of the pandemic. The first threat is the potential for transmission to spiral out of control at the universities and jump into the communities. And the second threat is the transmission is the potential for transmission to uptake with the reopening of schools. And so we face those threats currently at the same time. Now, as we reopen these schools and get our younger children back into school, we need to understand that that is not, you know, tipping us over the edge in terms of transmission and give us an early warning of increasing transmission. So that has a lot of value, in my opinion. And it's not looking for going from non-detection in Syracuse to a level of detection. It'll be increasing the quantifiable levels that are observed. So. And Emily, there's another question about SUNY Oswego, whether the outbreak would have been larger. My guess is that it would have, yes. And talking with SUNY Oswego leadership, you know, the wastewater data were used in their decisions to suspend classes for a couple weeks.
We've got another question. How have there been ways the results have been used to inform down to the dorm level or block level to suggest what people should do?
So at the dorm level, we use it to prompt human testing of those dorms. And as we look at transmission in Syracuse University campus, the public dashboard, you know, we had a little bit of rise of cases over the weekend. I think it was, you know, I was getting texts or messages from colleagues that saying, like, are you guys going to be okay? And then relieved messages after saying, hey, well done flattening that curve. At the university level, we're able to see which dorms with that probability of absence, right, which dorms are clear of coronavirus, and then which dorms we need to focus our efforts on. And it's been an invaluable tool in that regard. And then at the neighborhood level, it's going to be a little bit more nuanced because you're not going to get down to the level of the dorm. But working with the county health department in Albany, they're able to see within their city, all right, we have a little bit of a trouble spot happening in this section, right? And we did detect a bit of a rise in Albany with the outbreak at SUNY Albany. And then using the wastewater, the county health department can then see, all right, where has this spread? Where is this going next? And it gives them understanding before they'll see that with the human case data. And so as we refine the tools for county health departments to use, it will be an invaluable resource.
So we've got a question. If you find positives in the wastewater, are residents where you can, you know, track it back, are residents in that area required to be tested?
Well, in terms of communities, you know, we're not at a point where we're compelling people to be tested in any capacity. It can guide people to come get tested and prompt that. And it can guide understanding of what transmission is like in areas where people are resistant to testing. At Syracuse University, we have a Stay Safe Pledge where students agree to be tested as often as warranted. And these tests that we're doing at Syracuse University are saliva swabs, so they're not invasive. They're not the nasopharyngeal brain ticklers. And so we'll test every student. Some students will be tested like 10 times throughout the semester, others 15, 20 times, others, the lowest any student will be tested is 5 times this semester.
What is the expandability or future of something like this if, you know, hopefully not, but if the next pandemic comes down, is this something that can kind of be transferred to a different disease that we would see?
Yeah, hi, you want to take this one?
Sure. Yeah, right. You know, we, thinking back, I mean, we really wish we had this up and running, right, in January, December, ready to go, right? But really, you know, unfortunately there wasn't an existing wastewater-based epidemiology platform like this ready to go. And so I think that's part of what we're trying to do is using, you know, SARS-CoV-2, we're illustrating the future utility of a method like this. And yeah, it could be SARS-CoV-3 that it's useful for, maybe influenza. You know, Dave mentioned, I think at the top, antibiotic resistance, or other viruses, you know, or other pathogens that don't have to be viral, fungal or bacterial pathogens as well. We are reliant on those pathogens being excreted and ending up in the wastewater system. That is, you know, that is a requirement that we have, because obviously if it doesn't get in the wastewater, then we're not going to detect it using this platform. So, I think we've illustrated this tool as being extremely useful, and it would be very, very easy to switch over to the next pathogen. Like Dave mentioned, the difficult part, I think, is getting the logistics of sampling coordinated and figured out. I mean, you know, the scale of something like this, it's a monumental effort to coordinate.
The question about scaling, what are the biggest challenges in scaling this to other cities, counties, states or nationwide?
I think nationwide, that there are no challenges. I think if the Congress or the president decided that we want a nationwide platform, that it could be scaled within months, you know, with a decentralized approach with different groups that are working on this around the country. At the state level, we're, you know, and Governor Cuomo's been visionary in the state pilot, and as that wraps up, we hope that this moves forward to a state platform. And then at the county level and the municipal level, the biggest challenge is funding. And so each wastewater sample has a cost to collection, and county health or county sanitation and municipal sanitation and all of our cities are facing, you know, economic hardship with the pandemic and potential furlough. And so personnel time is limited. And then the cost of the sample itself is quadrant charges $300 per sample analyzed. And that can be cost prohibitive at this time. On our team, our challenge has been in telling the story that we have, that this is working, without seeing in upstate New York a big rise in cases after we got it working. And that's a great scientific challenge, because it's easy to see an early warning when your transmission is spiraling out of control, like we've observed in some of the other states. In upstate New York, transmission has been largely contained. And so we have a few different cases where we've had an outbreak it hasn't spiraled out of control because of the great responses from those communities, from the county health departments, from the universities. But we've had those outbreaks, and so we can pull out those case studies to see that this has been working as an early warning. And then the historical, you know, there's never been an appetite for decades in this country to fund public health surveillance to the level that would protect us from pandemic threat, right? And so I think of this wastewater surveillance as a smoke detector in our communities. And it's like we live in a country and a state and a county with living without a smoke detector prior to the pandemic. So then when we see something happening in New York City, when something happens in the larger cities around the country, we have to shut down the entire country as a result. Whereas if we had a smoke detector at the time, back in January, we'd be able to see like, all right, we have a few cases here, and we'd be able to make a data-driven decision in our less vulnerable counties upstate New York and avoid some of the economic hardships that we've been through as a result of the pandemic. Hopefully that makes sense.
We've got a question. If you hadn't started this platform, what is the biggest risk the college communities that you studied could have faced?
So if SUNY Oneonta had not been an early adopter of this technology, you know, had the vision to use it, then they would have responded to their cases a week later, because that's when their mass testing was scheduled. So because they had the vision to say, let's do wastewater surveillance, they were able to accelerate their mass testing program and cut off that outbreak. And then we still need to assess and evaluate how many infections that may have prevented. But I think it's quite a few, especially if your outbreak is doubling every few days, right? Then a week, you know, potentially decrease that outbreak by half. But we need to do the science on that. And so that's an example of how effective that has been.
Okay, I'd just like to add something to that. You know, in the SUNY Oneonta case, that they use the wastewater surveillance data to target testing. We know our testing capacity, our swab testing capacity is limited. And so that's one advantage of wastewater, is to use it to aim your limited resources and to prioritize areas that need that testing sooner than other areas.
All right, we've got a question about the communities around college campuses. What can the people in the communities surrounding a college campus or university use this to find comfort in it?
Where I would use this in a community, particularly Oneonta, is that it's gone back down. The levels have gone down in the wastewater treatment plant there. And so over time, to watch it, to take comfort that, all right, we're back to normal. You know, an outbreak like that is, you know, that was very intense, very fast, alarming, and fear-inducing, right? And so then, as it comes down, you're able to say, all right, we've got it under control. And how valuable is that? Is that piece that you can give to the public around it to say, all right, we're coming back down, we need to stay vigilant. And then once it's gone, then you're able to say, all right, it's gone. And then you start, you know, estimating the probability that it's actually gone and getting more and more confidence in what we're doing. And so, you know, I'm from the school of thought that we're going to be with this pandemic for at least another year and a half, perhaps, until we have a full protection from a vaccinated population. And so with that, we have to take advantage of when transmission is low, and then scale back our social engagement, our economic activity when transmission goes up. And this early warning of decreases as well as increases will help us to balance safety of our loved ones with the need we have to be social, to be economically engaged, and avoid the greater hardship from, you know, isolating ourselves in our houses for prolonged periods of time.
All right, knowing that the elderly are very susceptible, Would using this for senior living and nursing homes be appropriate, or has that kind of been addressed or looked at?
Yeah, and I think, you know, early nursing homes, early warning of transmission in those nursing homes, this would be able to prompt testing. One of the challenges that would be there is that not every person, about half of people that are infected with SARS-2 shed in the feces. And so you need to have a temporal, you need to account for that in your sampling plan. So you're doing it multiple times per week. And you may see like a little outbreak, like 2 to 3 infections before you see that signal, just based on probabilities. The other challenge in nursing homes is people that the solid waste disposal. So if residents are not using the toilet, if they have, for health reasons, then that you won't pick it up in that regard. But in terms of as another tool, it would be helpful, I think, for nursing homes and senior living centers. And the big thing is to think through when you install a wastewater surveillance outside of residential halls, you have to first identify what's our follow-up plan. When we get detection, are we going to go through and test? Or if we get detection, are we going to wait to see if it goes up before we test? And so that's an important piece as well. And then beyond senior living and nursing homes, prisons, another large building, large manufacturing plants and different industry campuses. It's just a super cost effective way to do it.
All right, looks like we don't have any further questions. So again, thank you so much to our speakers, Dr. David Larson and Dr. Hyatt Green. And thank you to all our participants for the great questions. And we will be posting this video online so that you can view it or share it with folks who weren't able to attend. And I hope everyone stays safe and has a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thanks, Emily. Thank you, everybody.
Yep, thank you.